about killed me a couple times. I still have thyroid problem, and I have high cholesterol. And those are all associated with CA.
Today, Earl Botkin doesn't have a colon anymore. He, too, is living with an ostotomy bag.
So all of a sudden, you don't function normally, but you have your bowel movement on your side. And that's what I'll live with until I die. And there's not any hope of that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat. And just controls a lot of things in my life. But anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions.
I wanted to show you these sentences here.
But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument, it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it before money. That's the only reason they continued to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh.
He lives long enough.
If I live to be 150, I'm right. It's kind of, there will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document, another number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview. So we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reach the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
We'll respectfully decline the on-camera interview. I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic, and you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant and the Parkersburg citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today, we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your piece.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly. In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth, and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?
Merged together, Dow Chemical and DuPont create the world's largest chemical company in terms of sales. Yet, the victims' testimonies, those whose lives have been poisoned, will forever cast a shadow over this industry as they fight in the hope that someday their culprits will be brought to justice. And that's it for this week, everyone. Join us next time for another documentary. It's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration added another repressive measure against migrants on top of Donald Trump's already draconian Title 42. Now Border Patrol agents have the right to decide asylum cases, says Tatiana Cazzarelli, writer in an article titled Biden is expediting deportations of migrant families. Stay tuned for more. On the campaign trail, Biden promised humane immigration policies, seeking to win votes from all those people horrified by the concentration camps at the border and the draconian immigration policies of Donald Trump. But as president, Biden is a continuation of not a break with Trump. Recently, the Biden administration gave one more example of this. The administration announced that it will remove migrant families without due process. If border officials deem a family unqualified for asylum, they will be deported immediately. Expedited removal provides a lawful, more accelerated procedure to remove those family units who do not have a basis under U.S. law to be in the United States, the Department of Homeland Security said. What this really means is that terrified migrants fleeing persecution, violence, and sexual assault, who are making a long, violent, and terrifying trek to the U.S., will be interrogated by border agents. These migrants are fleeing their home countries because of the imperialist policies that have created violence, instability, and abject poverty. They have survived political persecution, violence, sexual assault, and a long, dangerous trajectory to the border. And when they arrive to the border, asylum cases can and will be decided by the mood, the xenophobia, and the extortion of Border Patrol agents, who are both prosecutor and judge. It means border agents will be in charge of deciding if immigrants have a credible fear of persecution on the spot. Camille Mackler, founder and executive director of Immigrant ARC, said, "The expedited removal procedure involves sitting across a desk from a government agent, signing a deportation order. There is no ability to see a judge, consult with a legal advocate, much less an attorney, or otherwise understand the process. This is on top of the rule enacted in the Trump era known as Title 42, which allows the United States to immediately send migrants back across the border even if they wish to make an asylum claim. But Title 42 removals aren't enough for Biden. The Department of Homeland Security announced that certain family units who are not able to be expelled under Title 42 will be placed in expedited removal proceedings. Ray says Texas tweeted, "This is new policy is Title 42 on steroids. The expansion of the ability to deport just about anyone who arrives at the southern border, including children." Immigrants' rights activists argue that expedited removal and Title 42 result in longer stays in customs and border protection facilities where migrants experience inhumane and violent conditions. Robin Barnard, senior advocacy counsel at Human Rights First, tweeted, "The whole point of expedited removal is to summarily deport PPW out seeing a judge to make their claim for asylum. DHS locks them up in prisons while they effect these summary deportations, and it all happens in quick succession to make it cheaper for government." Like every Democrat who came before him, Biden uses more humane language to cover up brutal policies against migrants. While there are open borders for capital with free trade agreements that facilitate the exploitation of workers, people are barred entry. This isn't just about one law. Title 42 is based on a 1944 public health statute to close the border to non-essential travel. Trump revived this policy in March 2020. It has been maintained and now expanded under the Biden administration despite protests and lawsuits. As a result, explains the LA Times, U.S. border officials have claimed unchecked unilateral authority to summarily expel from the country hundreds of thousands of immigrants, adults, families, and unaccompanied minors who didn't have prior permission to enter without due process or access to asylum, let alone testing for the coronavirus. In the year of Title 42, less than 1% have been able to seek protection in the U.S., and Title 42 was applied to over 80% of migrants. This included 16,000 unaccompanied minors and 34,000 children expelled alongside their parents. Human rights lawyers and the United Nations say Title 42 is illegal because it's almost impossible to get asylum through this process. Lawyers claim that Biden, like Trump, is breaking international law. The Biden administration's use of Title 42 is flatly illegal, said Lee Glarant of the American Civil Liberties Union, which sued the Trump administration over the policy. The Biden administration is now defending the policy in court. There is zero daylight between the Biden administration and the Trump administration's position, Glarant said. The truth is that Biden's policies aren't fair or humane, and Biden has no solutions for migrants. The expedited removal is actually more draconian than Trump's already brutal policies. It means that even more people will be deported, and it gives the Border Patrol an absurd amount of power. It means an expansion of already brutal laws. Rachel Sheridan, litigation counsel at Tahrir Justice Center, said, because of this policy, women seeking protection from domestic violence, sexual violence, human trafficking, and other forms of gender-based harm could be deported without having the chance to prove their case for asylum. There is no fixing the broken system based on militarization and borders. After all, immigration is the result of imperialist policies, and with climate change, people won't stop being displaced. And the criminalization of immigrants is convenient for employers in the U.S. It allows the super exploitation of migrants who are treated as second-class citizens. The Biden administration's immigration policies have continued those of Trump, with kinder and more polite language, like the explanation by Susan Rice. But the brutality continues. The concentration camps on the border are overcrowded and lack basic health supplies. Kids are still in cages, and sexual assaults of children have been reported at facilities that remain open. Migrants are merely fleeing the results of U.S. imperialism, the coups that destabilize countries, the debt that forces austerity of semi-colonial countries, the U.S. corporations and their low wages, the climate change created by the wealthiest people in the world and U.S. corporations. Americans cannot be pacified by Biden's kind imperialism rhetoric. He is maintaining and escalating the brutal policies of Trump and his Democratic and Republican predecessors. This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. An Israeli-owned ship was attacked off of Oman. Sources close to the resistance say that the attack was in response to Israeli attacks in Syria, especially the one on an airport in Syria's western Qusair region, where two resistance fighters were killed. Now, Tel Aviv is pointing the finger at Iran for the raid, where two crew members were killed. So far, Tehran has not commented on the attack. Stay with us as we take a look at the story on The Spotlight. Well, I'd like to start it all off crossing over to Damascus and talking to Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on what you know about this situation.
Yes, what we know is that there was an Israeli-owned ship attacked about 280 kilometers northeast of the coast of Oman. Of course, we have a resistance source that told the media that the attack was in response to the Israeli attack that happened about 10 days ago on Al-Qusair area, which is an area on the borderline between Syria and Lebanon, of course, on the Syrian side. Of course, Syria did not comment on the issue. However, Syria sent tens of letters to the United Nations Security Council calling on the international body on every, of course, Israeli attack to shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security and taking measures against Israel in order to stop it from carrying out such attacks. Now, it really seems that the resistance source, by, of course, giving such information, is saying that resistance forces in this region will not allow Israel anymore to attack resistance forces, to attack sovereign countries, and there will be a price for every attack. This is the first message that the resistance in the region wants to send to Israel. The second is a message to the international community. Of course, as I told you, Syria sent letters to the United Nations, called on the international community to do something. Nothing was done in the past 10 years. Israel continues to occupy Syria and attack it. And this is the second message, that if the international community is not going to do anything about such illegal attacks, the resistance will do.
All right, thanks so much for that update out of Damascus. That's Muhammad Ali. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, political commentator Mohammed Obaid out of Beirut, and journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Beirut. And Mohammed, well, a source close to the resistance says this attack was a retaliation for Israeli aggression in Syria. Your take on the possibility of that and the importance of it, if it's true?
Well, first of all, you have to take into account that this method is being used in correspondence with what the Israelis have been doing. They have always been launching aggressions against Syria, against other areas, and letting the Arab press media report that it was Israel without the Israelis adopting this. But sometimes the Israeli officials could not take it anymore, and they used to brag about these aggressions and say that it was up to them to prevent the, what they call the axis of evil, which we call the axis of resistance, in order to claim a responsibility for these attacks. So what the resistance source has really done recently is that they have adopted the policy of this ambiguity, sort of, because you don't have an official claiming of responsibility by the Islamic Republic or by any resistance group, but it is understood that this is coming as part of or as a retaliation to the Israeli aggression against the Qusair area in Syria. So the Israelis are not really used to this, because throughout their history they have been acting with this thuggish way of behaving against other countries, against sovereign countries, and the world has always been turning the blind eye to these aggressions. So it is up to you then to defend yourself in order to sort of tit for tat. I mean, you have to make the aggressor pay a price for the aggressions that they are carrying out.
Said Moshe, your perspective, the significance of this Israeli ship being hit.
Well, the significance is that we no longer have a one-way traffic in terms of the Israelis routinely trying to roll out their Yinon plan by attacking their neighbors. We no longer have a free run for the Israelis to balkanize the Middle East. They no longer have the fear factor which they cultivated over many decades to cow all opposition into submission, of course, with some backup. It was the American military backup which previously kept them floating. They actually are capable of making their own arms and are increasingly self-sufficient in that respect, but they still get over $3.8 billion worth of aid on paper. It's probably a lot more privately through all the American Zionist donors. So we know that Israel has used this kind of backup of American imperialism to create chaos and to create, terror in that region. Syria has been, of course, it's one of its major targets from a very long time. Basically, Syria did back the Palestinian movement in the region. They did back the Lebanese resistance. They were always, even under Hafez al-Assad, stoically opposed Israeli imperialism and its the practices that they were carrying out in the region. And of course, as time's gone on, what we've seen is the Israelis have been part and parcel of the creation of the civil war in Syria, first of all, then the launch of ISIS in Syria and Iraq and beyond. Israel is very much behind that. They not only are behind it, but they've also been servicing, training, and medically supporting the ISIS proxy forces in that region. So you can see there are multiple layers of Israeli provocation and, aggression against certainly Syria, certainly against Lebanon, certainly against all nations that want sovereignty and independence intact. In response, what we've seen is the confidence of the resistance growing. It started with Hezbollah managing to defeat, essentially, Israel's invasion of Lebanon, not once, but twice. And since then, it's the resistance that has been arguably on the front foot. Israel now relies on aerial power, terror from the air. But even that is becoming even more suspect, because we've seen Israeli missiles being intercepted, destroyed by Syrian air defense. Some argue it's the Russians who are doing that. Either way, it is Syria on paper which is rebutting Israel's attack. So it's actually reducing Israel's credibility as an undisputed power in that region.
Well, Mohammed, what about that? I mean, we've been seeing Israel illegally bombing Syria for years now. And now with the situation, with the bombing of this Israeli ship, we're seeing outrage being expressed by these Western countries. And mum is the word, more or less, when Israel continues to violate Syrian territory. Do you think this hypocrisy by these Western countries have revealed themselves more and more as far as their real intentions in dealing with this region, especially when it comes to Israel?
Well, we have to keep into account, we have to keep in our minds that if it weren't for the political and military and the financial aid provided by the Western countries, Israel would not even survive for one day in the region within this hostile atmosphere and environment that is everybody in the region regards Israel as an illegitimate entity that was based and erected on the usurpery of the land by of the Palestinians. So if it weren't for this political support of this turning the blind eye by the West to the Israeli aggressions and all the massacres that have been going on throughout our region for over 70 years now, if Israel would not have been able to keep going with that. But this turns the other side, the side that is taking the blows, I mean, the other countries, the countries that have been receiving the aggressions of the Israeli entity, turn more bold because you cannot remain on the side of the being killed while remaining silent. So you have to manage, you have to develop your own methods of defending yourself, defending your country, defending the sovereignty of your country. So this is a rational and logical development of events in the region. If you have any other country in the world just demanding them, putting them their back to the wall, receiving attacks all the time by an aggressive force, it is natural and more than natural to just retaliate in order to stop the aggression against you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mohsen, what about that? Do you think that the narrative has basically changed and we've gone from a time where Israel would basically deal with hit and run, but now we're more likely to see a tit for tat, and Tel Aviv realizes and understands that the transition has taken place?
Absolutely, it does, and their military generals have acknowledged this. I think, in practical terms, you can see from their tactics every time that there is a head-on collision with any of the resistance, and I'm including the Palestinian resistance most recently, if we include the Lebanese resistance, or even if we talk about, you know, the Syrian resistance. The fact of the matter is that Israel no longer rattles its saber in the way that it used to. What it does now, it does this kind of lower form of, if you like, tit for tat, as you put it, quite succinctly. That's just designed to really make everybody think that they've still got, the nerve to face up to the resistance axis. But increasingly, what we're seeing is that they are not even able to outright launch land invasions, for instance. They didn't do it again with Gaza, you know, that open-air prison camp which they maintained. They couldn't really do exactly what they wanted after so many Palestinian resistance missiles violated their so-called Iron Dome. So again, the Iron Dome has been shattered as an impregnable defense mechanism, and that's been done by the resistance axis's own tactics, which penetrated the Israeli defense. We know that in Lebanon, the much-wanted Israeli military, with its state-of-the-art tanks, etc., was taken out by very simple Lebanese Hezbollah forces tactics, using particular anti-tank missiles in a certain way where they could hit these tanks from both angles, shocking the Israeli forces and actually forcing their retreat inflicting a major damage to the morale of the army, which I don't think they recovered. It's admitted even by the Israeli generals themselves that they don't have that scale of morale. What's happening now is really a fundamental sea change. You have an Israeli defense force of basically young people that they conscript, they're forced to serve in the army, essentially. They've got the resistance axis, which because of the Israeli and the Zio-American shenanigans in the Middle East, have been now trained with wars in Syria, with wars in Iraq, with wars across that region, which have been instigated by these Zio-imperialists, trained up. They basically made those forces battle-hardened. And what the Israeli Defense Force is scared of is that their own individual conscripts, who've never faced a real war, haven't fought real soldiers or a real army, mm-hmm. for that matter, are not really up to the job. They're therefore relying on aircraft attacks or internet warfare or these little tactical hijacking attacks of ships around the world. That's what they're reduced to.
Well, Mohammed, now Iran has said that it holds Israel responsible for terrorist attacks against it, and that Tehran will protect this region against aggression. I mean, what exactly does that mean? Do you think that it means that anywhere in the region where Tel Aviv crosses Tehran's red lines could mean trouble for the Zionist regime?
Yes, absolutely. But if you follow up the Israeli media today, you'd just be astonished at how much they have been confused, how much they have been contradicting each other. You have reports that are blaming Israel for itself, itself for playing with fire in the first place. You have some politicians, Israeli politicians, claiming that they would need to retaliate for that attack. And then you have others just quoting officials that they will report the case to the UN and they will have their case there. So a sort of confusion, as I said in the first section of my what I said, the Israelis are not used to this. They have been used to be the thug of the area and then launch aggressions against all the peoples of the region and then returning home safely with their warplanes and so, and then receiving a pat on the shoulder by the Americans and the other Western forces, and this country or that European country is offering them official and, financial and economic aid this way or another. You have, for example, you see the fruits and the produce of the settlements, the occupied settlements that the whole world believes are occupied and the UN believes are occupied Palestinian territories. You have them offered the special and favorite way of treatment by the European countries. So you see, the whole thing is a new phase for the mm-hmm. Israelis, always been used to just launch aggressions and go unpunished.
What about that transition, said Mohsen? I mean, overall, what does this attack say about the strength of the resistance and the change, as Mohammed was just talking about, that the regime in Tel Aviv is not used to this type of response?
Well, you can clearly see the progression from the very confident Israeli war stances during the Yom Kippur War and, you know, even in the time of the conquest of the Golan Heights. And you can see the difference in the postures of the Israelis. And that's primarily one of a much more cautious, much more defensive, much more nervous nature on the Israelis' part. That's purely and simply because they recognize and they understand, their intelligence services, their military intelligence understands the military capabilities which the resistance axis now has. Of course, the raids in Syria are primarily a sort of a knee-jerk, nervous reaction to the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran has free brotherly access to Syrian territory in order to defend Syria's sovereignty, which has been violated again by ISIS and the sort of forces that the Western imperialists have been imposing on Syria. But that nervousness obviously manifests with these kind of constant aerial raids. That's the only area in which the Israelis now feel that they have a clear superiority. Of course, the other area that we need to consider is the ballistic missile capability. And Israel will argue that, well, we're going in to destroy the capability of Iran, particularly in Syria, or the Syrians themselves, of being able to launch ballistic missile attacks from those territories. This is, quite frankly, nonsense. What they're really doing is they're just trying to keep up appearances for their own citizens. Look, when the Israelis bomb or try to attack Syrian sites, there's no confirmation of the actual locations that they're hitting actually being of any real significance. You know, casualties are reported, all too often civilian casualties. Israel itself doesn't provide any evidence that they've been able to take out so-called military or Iranian military bases, or Syrian ones for that matter. What's really going on is quite often they're just going through an exercise of trying to look like they're still in the game. The Russians have an interesting role to play in this. they could give S-400s to the Syrian air defense or the resistance. They could. They certainly say they've given S-300s, and we know that Israeli missiles have been intercepted. So clearly there is a deterrence power that the resistance has. Iran itself has highly sophisticated ballistic missiles, which they demonstrated with their destruction of Ain al-Assad base in Iraq when the Americans went for their own mad scheme of killing and martyring Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. So what we've got is a situation now where the old Israeli-American imperialism is desperately trying to keep its own citizens, its own people on board to say, look, we still have the capability to defend you. They're losing that battle, because what we've got is the resistance axis proving day on day that they are getting ever closer to really shutting down the illegitimate Israel occupation.
Okay, stay with him, say it most. What about that, Mohammed? Do you think that Tel Aviv is more vulnerable today than it ever has been in its existence?
Yes, of course. But the more important is the impact of this whole thing. I mean, strategically speaking, that the role of Israel, and this, by the way, a statement was made by current President Joe Biden, explaining why he supports Israel. He says that Israel is cheaper than any warplane carrier or whatever that we would put here in order to put our troops. This tells you about the function that the West sees in Israel. Israel that used to launch aggressions, as we've been saying since the beginning of the show, throughout its history, 70 years ago, is now unable to launch an aggression on Gaza without expecting a retaliation. So this is means a major change and a shift in the function of Israel. Israel is no longer the barricade or the barracks of the West.
Okay.
They are not in order to take a certain product from that entity.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I'd love to continue talking about this, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us. Political commentator Mohammed Obaid out of Beirut. Journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Roughly 74 million lives could be saved this century if the emission of heat-trapping gases is cut to zero by 2050, compared with a far more lethal scenario in which society fails to limit global temperature rise to less than 4 degrees Celsius, says Kenny Stencil, writer, in an article published under the heading Eliminating Carbon Emissions by 2050 would save 74 million lives this century, study shows. Stay tuned for more. Providing further evidence of the deadly consequences of the fossil fuel-driven climate emergency and the far-reaching health benefits of decarbonization, new research shows eliminating greenhouse gas emissions within the next 3 decades would save tens of millions of lives around the world. Roughly 74 million lives could be saved this century if the emission of heat-trapping gases is cut to zero by 2050. Compared with a far more lethal scenario in which society fails to limit global temperature rise to less than 4 degrees Celsius, That's according to Daniel Bressler, a PhD candidate at Columbia University's Earth Institute, whose peer-reviewed journal article, The Mortality Cost of Carbon, was just published in Nature Communications. There is a significant number of lives that can be saved if you pursue climate policies that are more aggressive than the business-as-usual scenario, Bressler told The Guardian. I was surprised at how large the number of deaths is. There is some uncertainty over this. The number could be lower, but it could also be a lot higher. Bressler acknowledged that his projections of excess deaths from carbon emissions may well be a vast underestimate, as they only account for heat-related mortality rather than deaths from flooding, storms, crop failures, and other impacts that flow from the climate crisis, the newspaper noted. For instance, a study on fossil fuel-related air pollution, not extreme heat, published in February found that exposure to particulate matter from dirty energy emissions killed an estimated 8.7 million people in 2018 alone, accounting for 18% of total global deaths that year. The new study released recently builds upon a concept called the social cost of carbon, a measurement created by Nobel Prize-winning economist William Nordhaus to estimate the economic and environmental damage associated with pumping one metric ton of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Bressler said Nordhaus came up with a fantastic model, but he didn't take in the latest literature on climate change's damage upon mortality. As NPR noted recently, the connection between a hotter planet and human death and disease has become clearer thanks to a series of research papers. A study published in 2021 found that about a third of heat-related deaths worldwide can be directly attributed to human-caused climate change. A 2020 Lancet report warned that climate change is the biggest global public health threat of the century. Those findings, however, have not been factored into one of the three major computer models that scientists, economists, and the federal government use to calculate the social cost of carbon, NPR reported, meaning that policymakers may be underestimating the cost of climate change to human life. Bressler's research seeks to fill that gap, and he hopes the findings will be helpful to a federal working group currently reasserting and reassessing how the government calculates the costs and benefits of climate policies, the news outlet added. According to Nordhaus' DICE model, the 2020 social cost of carbon is $37 a metric ton, but when Bressler accounts for the mortality cost, this figure climbs to $258 a ton. Bressler pointed out that a more accurate assessment of the negative consequences of carbon is especially important now that Congress and state governments are contemplating major investments to upgrade the nation's infrastructure and slash U.S. emissions in half from 2005 levels by 2030. After analyzing the temperature-related mortality impacts of carbon pollution, Bressler concludes that for every 4,434 metric tons of carbon dioxide emitted in 2020, one person will die prematurely from a heat-related illness between 2020 and 2100. He notes that 4,434 metric tons is equivalent to the lifetime emissions of 3.5 average Americans, 146.2 Nigerians, and 12.8 average world people. In a study last year on carbon inequality, Oxfam and Stockholm Environmental Institute found that the world's richest 1% emits more than twice as much carbon dioxide as the poorest 50% of humanity, while 63 million people were responsible for 15% of global emissions between 1990 and 2015. 3.1 billion were responsible for just 7%. Vast global disparities in greenhouse gas emissions are undeniable and a reflection of massive levels of inequality between wealthy and impoverished countries. However, given the high levels of inequality within rich countries and the presence of a small class of super emitters, as well as the U.S. military's enormous carbon footprint, it would be misleading to suggest that every person in the global north contributes equally to causing the climate crisis. Brussels data show that a coal-fired power plant is much deadlier than the emissions associated with an average American. The mortality cost of carbon implies that removing a year's worth of carbon dioxide emissions from an average coal-fired power plant in the United States in 2020 saves 904 lives in expectation from 2020 to 2100. Pressler told The Guardian that ordinary working people shouldn't take their per-person mortality emissions too personally. The emissions are very much a function of the technology and culture of the place that people live. For that reason, progressives have long argued that policymakers should focus on implementing society-wide changes to reduce inequality and carbon pollution simultaneously by creating millions of unionized jobs in the renewable energy sector and providing an abundance of low-carbon public goods rather than perpetuating high-carbon forms of individual consumption.